Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Commercial Property Investor Podcast, where it's my job to introduce you to people from the world of commercial property. We're talking with investors and thought leaders about their experiences of the commercial property world and sharing our own lessons from the last 20 years to give you practical know-how so that you can follow in their footsteps. If you've ever thought commercial could be your next step, but it just seems too confusing and opaque, then you've come to the right place. There are so many exciting opportunities in this dynamic sector, and I'm looking forward to pulling back the curtain and sharing them with you.
Maybe keep your ears to the ground. That might be an area where you should go and invest, because you might find that there's a, as you say, a pot of money that might actually help you purchase the building as well.
Welcome back to the Commercial Property Investor Podcast. And I've got Anthony Boyce here. We're going to go through more specifics about listed buildings now. And we did an episode a couple of weeks ago about Anthony's business and his experiences so far as a developer and all the other shiny pennies that, that he's involved in. And I wanted to do something really more specific, Anthony, about people who are thinking about doing listed. Mm-hmm. And what they need to be prepared for, right? Because some people think this is just something I need to stay away from. But actually, you and I, as we discussed before, we love these buildings.
Absolutely.
Yep. You know, there can be some really interesting projects to work on and financial benefits, mm-hmm. right? But there is an extra layer here. So I just want to demystify that a little bit. And there's a few things I want to go through. First of all, just what the process is and the additional things that people need to think about. Two, is it really worth it? Maybe some of the benefits that we've both had from working with these types of properties. And then the last thing really was just key things that maybe we've learned as we've gone through this process that sure. others could maybe think about for their projects, right? Mm-hmm. So first off, somebody who's used to maybe buying a flat or a house or maybe doing a small conversion, they've maybe got in the planning officer, they've put in a planning application for possibly change of use for some things, or they've maybe brought in building warrant, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But there's an extra layer here, right? So if we're looking at, you mentioned a church before, let's say a church, what are the additional things that people need to do in order to actually get a successful application?
Sure. So, yeah, with any listed building, and I guess you all have experienced the same, it's time.
Yep.
I guess just allow time. These buildings have been around for thousands, hundreds of years or whatever. A few extra months in planning process, you should definitely account for that in the process. So if you're on bridging and development finance,
sure, yeah,
make sure you've took it over 12, 18 months rather than just 6 to 9, because what I've found is often conservation officers are spread quite thin. You might have one who's in charge of 3 councils, 4 councils, one day a week, something like that. So getting responses from them often is
just talk through though, when I take on a listed building, what are the additional responsibilities I've got and the people that need to come into this decision-making process? Because normally with a flatted development, sure, we've got planning officers, right? Mm-hmm. And we've got planning consent, but or we hopefully get planning consent, right? We've got planning application, but it's one. With listed, there's an additional layer there.
Sure. So it's very similar to planning permission, but it's just a listed building consent. I don't know if it's called something different
in
Scotland. Yeah. So it's usually a free application. Most of the information that you need to supply will be very similar to a planning application, but there'll be an extra layer, I guess, of what damage or harm are you doing to the existing building.
Yep.
I guess recording what's there as well. So whenever you're working on a listed building, make sure you get as much detail as possible. We found with our church scheme, we used a Matterport walk around.
Yep.
And that was actually, we were able to use that as the recording survey as well. Just document everything. You will need a heritage consultant. Well, not always. Sometimes you might have a competent, you know, conservation architect or designer or someone like that. But you will need to provide extra documentation and a little bit of research into the history of the building, the surrounding area, and how your scheme is going to affect the building and, I guess, the wider area, the conservation area, and that kind of thing, or any nearby listed buildings sometimes.
I remember we had part of our obligations under planning permission for this building was we had to record digitally all of the makeup of the mortuary.
Right.
So that when we took out the slabs and stuff, there was historic records for it all. Mm-hmm. And then they allowed us to convert it. But actually, they wanted full and proper recording, video, camera, whatever.
Sometimes it's hand drawings, isn't it? You've got to send them off to basically an artist for them to draw them just so they can add them to publications and that kind of thing.
So basically what we're saying is you're going to need two, in tandem, you're going to have two planning applications here. One's going to be looked after from a historic building point of view and the other for your more traditional process.
Sure. And then what you'll find is a lot of the time the planning officer will rely on whatever the conservation officer finds or wants to say. So if they can basically, the conservation officer says no, that gives the planner something to say no, you know, this needs to change or I'm not going to allow that.
So in Scotland, my understanding is if it's a C-listed building, the guidance, sure, comes from Historic Scotland or whatever, but actually the decisions are still at local level.
Yeah.
It's when it becomes B and A listing or 2 and 1 grades in England that it then has to go to that other layer. So they then report back. Is that the same in England?
Yeah. So another layer on top of that one is we've worked within a UNESCO World Heritage Buffer Zone before and also on scheduled monuments. And at that level, it has to go to the Secretary of State.
Wow.
So in order to, this is where the time penalty comes in. So if you're waiting on a planning decision, but also you're going to central government to wait for them to give you permission to scratch a bit of a castle or something like that, just to do a bit of recording or do whatever, it can add a lot of extra time and layers of intricacies onto a project.
So is this whole thing a bit nuanced though? So some people say, you know, if it's an A-listed building, don't go anywhere near it.
Right.
Some people say if it's listed, don't go anywhere near it. Mm-hmm. But actually, what happens in a B-listed building in one location and a C-listed building in another location might be as much down to the local planning department as it is anything else. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, yeah. So with planning, there's a national framework, national policies. They might be tailored locally, but conservation and heritage is very much subjective to the person in charge of it often.
Yes.
Unless, of course, you're going up to central government and the higher authorities. So it can, the decision you get on a building, you know, could be exactly the same building, just in different boroughs, different councils. The advice and what you're allowed to do may be completely different between them.
Well, I think we're going to circle back to that because I want to talk about how we can maybe try and mitigate that.
Sure.
Right. But in terms of doing these properties, some of the benefits. So we mentioned at the end of the last discussion that you can't build an old building. So there's a finite amount. And in my space with, for instance, offices, fine, you can go build another glass box, which seems to be the defined default position for building a new office, right? We'll go and build another glass box. So when this one gets filled up, we'll go and build another one. And that's fine until the market changes. You've got a lot of glass boxes that all look the same and feel the same. And actually, when you've got historical buildings, because they don't build them anymore, and because they're usually quirky, there are features and benefits that some people think, oh my goodness, what am I going to do with this fireplace? But actually, those are some of the things that people want.
Yeah, people love a bit of history. Well, I think a lot of people do. I mean, I remember when you just gave us the tour of this building, you said it was only a courthouse for 20 years, was it? Or 10 years?
It's jail for 20 years.
Yeah. So the amount of times it's changed use over that time. So these buildings were built to last. They were built to be adapted and reused.
Yeah.
So that's all we're looking to do as well.
Yeah. So there's a definite appetite out there, certainly for the type of customers we've been dealing with, but also you think about restaurants, leisure spaces. If you've got a building with lots of nice, interesting features, then it's really difficult to replicate that because they are what they are, unique old historical buildings. So that's the first thing. And then also for me personally, I get a lot of satisfaction from bringing these things back to life, but it is so important they're sustainable that it's not government grants and perhaps a tenant or an occupant that's subsidized by the government, because then eventually that's going to stop.
Yeah.
So one of the critical things is making sure they are sustainable and the project you're doing is sustainable. Obviously, securing the building is an important element of it. But there are some grants and things out there, having said that about sustainability, that are one-offs. And one of the things that I've come across is that with those listed buildings, again, it does depend on what region you're in, even sometimes what town you're in. But there are sometimes little pots of money out there to help with certain aspects, not to help you line your pockets as a developer, as they suggest.
Crafty developers who try to work it that way, though.
But there are things like, so we've benefited from some grants where it was the brief was it's exterior only, right? So keeping the building wind and water tight, but also in continuing with the historical integrity of the building, right? So an example would be pointing or the stonework or potentially the roof, certainly the slating, these sorts of things where you can sometimes find pots of money to help with that sort of thing, and it can make a big difference, can't it? And that's another benefit, that it's really difficult sometimes to see where these pots are, but if you've got somebody working with you, then actually that can make or break a project, can't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a big push in Darlington where I'm based for certain areas. You say it's sometimes just councils. It can be streets.
Yes.
So just shop fronts in particular areas of Darlington at the moment where the council are giving people money to prettify them, to make them more like, you know, removing the kebab shop type aluminium shop fronts and putting the old timber palisters and things like that back on. Store rises and that kind of thing, so that there is a big push at the moment to bring back that heritage. So yeah, if you're lucky and you're looking in the right areas, maybe keep your ears to the ground. That might be an area where you should go and invest, because you might find that there's a, as you say, a pot of money that might actually help you purchase the building as well.
Yeah. Have you had any success with lottery funding or anything like that on any of the projects you've worked on?
Not yet, no. Not in the areas I've done things. Yeah. I do have friends who have got, like you say, money for helping with the external works of projects and that kind of thing in lower value areas, but I try and stay away from lower value areas, basically.
Yeah, we did put an application for lottery funding, not for building, for a business accelerator, but in the end, the strings that came with it made it actually just not viable.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes these things, you can't keep chasing and actually manipulating your project to suit some grant funding.
Yes.
That sometimes becomes a bit of an issue. People are just hell-bent on getting that grant, but actually it means the project isn't true to what it should be.
And is it viable in the first place if you're needing a handout to make it viable? Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. Have you heard of SaaS Pensions? They're a fantastic tool for business owners to wrap a commercial property up in a tax-free bubble. A SaaS can work particularly well with the CMO strategy to generate money both inside and outside of your pension. It goes without saying, I'm not a SaaS expert, but let me introduce you to someone that is. Bryn Walker has been advising on SaaS pensions for many years and has been a long-term supporter of the CPI network. SaaS and commercial property work incredibly well together, but there are many nuances, and Bryn will make sure you don't stray from the right path. Look in the show notes for the partner link and book up a SaaS discovery call with Bryn.
Then, I guess we're trying to save old buildings here, but why would you throw money away? Because a lot of these grant funding, anyway, you've got to spend the money to claim it back.
Yes.
If you're reliant on that money coming back and they don't give it for whatever reason, like you say, you haven't ticked the right box or something like that.
And one of the other things to consider is if you are buying a listed building and your intention is to sell it on, some of these things will come back and bite you in the bum. So as an example, some grants have a clawback. If you sell the building within 7 years, there'll be a pro rata clawback on the money that's put in. Or if you're developing a property and you're managing to work through the tax benefits of developing the building, and people talk a lot about capital allowances, right? Capital allowance is like the thing. Actually, it's got a big sting in the tail, and most people won't tell you that. So capital allowances, sure, you can claim them and offset your tax against them, but when you sell that building, it can come back and bite you in the arse. And these things can be really beneficial for these types of projects, but you have to think right up front, am I keeping this one or am I selling it? Because that forms part of your tax strategy. So one of the other things I want to talk about was, or the little serendipities, is when you've done one of these and you've done it well, and it can be difficult to get it going and it can be difficult to get buy-in from the planning office and everything else, but when you've done one and you've done it right, it opens a door a little bit. And it means that you're possibly working your way into a niche, and then you maybe get people coming to you and saying, I've got a building that maybe you could do, or in the terms of local authorities, we have some problem buildings that you might be able to, we can trust you because we see what you've done before, you've gone and actually done it, so now it's more a case of actually, can you do this project?
Yeah.
And there's a bit, as I say, the word trust. In fact, I was having a meeting just last week with some planning officers and stuff, and it was the same thing. It was like, well, actually, we have seen what you've done, so we're more willing to support and help you because we understand what your ethos is, right? So there is that thing about building a track record.
Yeah.
And if you stick with it, that's another one of those little things that can start coming back and help you. I guess that's the same with most businesses if you're starting to niche, but it's actually going out there and doing it first.
Yeah, proof of concept. Yeah, I like to call it that. But no, I mean, wouldn't that be amazing if the council brought you old buildings to develop, and often they will give them away for free.
There's that conversation can start being opened up because now you're not just kicking tires, you've actually gone and done it, right? And it's funny, actually, I'm sure they won't be listening to this podcast. you know, the actual conversation does come around to, well, actually, do you know what? This building is currently worth nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to give it to you for nothing, but it's actually worth nothing. And if we don't do something with it, we're going to have a bigger hole in the ground here and an issue. So there is a more pragmatic approach to actually, what can we do to solve this problem? And we know from your track record that actually you are on the same page as us.
Yeah. But I would be careful there as well. So yeah, I mean, if the council are approaching you with things like this, when you're looking at buildings, though, don't assume because the council are selling it that you're going to get a green light, basically, from planning.
Yeah.
I've had a few clients where, the estates department are selling this and they've told me planning won't be a problem.
Oh, yeah, that's all going to be done first.
Yes, do not take that.
Don't let your leverage go.
Yeah.
Yeah, wait till you've got it all sorted out first. And we talked about you can't build old buildings. I think those quirky features for my sector that I'm in seem to be coming more and more into it. Like when we're doing viewings in these buildings, people are half here just, they're not here to do this, but they're enjoying the whole architectural historical part. Maybe it's just because I enjoy talking about it, right? And actually they don't care. But it seems like people are more and more interested in that sort of thing, that history, that story. And they talk about marketing is that marketing stories. But when you have a property that has stories linked to it, it just becomes so much easier, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of romantic in a way, isn't it, when you're dealing with people want to work in them spaces, they want to stay in them spaces. It's a little bit of heritage. I mean, I always think when sort of you're walking up the steps of a castle or something like that, all of the famous people and, you know, kings and queens and stuff that have passed through before. Yeah.
Do you have any other benefits that you've seen from doing listed buildings that maybe we've not spoken about there before we go on to just some of the challenges that people need to watch out for?
I mean, it could be a benefit, I suppose, but a lot of the time heritage and conservation might trump building control. So you might not have to, let's say in terms of fire or something like that, you might not have to upgrade a certain element. You mentioned about lath and plaster. That's a terrible, terrible fire retardant material. You can't guarantee
the back of it.
Exactly. Yep. You can't guarantee how thick it is and that kind of thing. But you might not have to take a wall down or upgrade it. The doors, for example, as well. You know, these are old historic doors. EPCs as well aren't relevant sometimes. So you might not have to upgrade the fabric of a building. Of course, that's a double-edged sword because if you're operating it longer term, you might want to save on your electric bills and your heating bills. But again, for that money, that cash input up front, that might just pull a building round as viable.
It's a good point. And that does bleed in a little bit to that conversation about when you're buying a commercial building, if you don't have to change use, building control is really quite different. Because now you're not starting from scratch. You're going with what is and trying to improve it. Again, there still depends on who you're talking to and who the officer is and how lucky you are or not with who you get. But we found that in general, if we're not changing the class of use, we've been able to get much more of what we feel we need for the building to work rather than what necessarily gets prescribed. Is that your experience?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a light bulb moment when he came and spoke at our event, the property thing, because I think, as you'd mentioned, the default is this has to, it's going to make more financial sense by converting this into residential.
Yeah.
But like you say there, by not having separating floors, separating walls, fire systems, or as many fire systems, let's say, you can, as many kitchens, service inputs and all that kind of stuff, you can actually take the build cost right down. So I guess why default to resi when things like you're doing with the flour mill and things are fantastic? And I don't know the build costs, but I'd imagine it might have been a lot less than putting 20 flats in there, maybe.
I would say so. We've done the numbers on it, okay, on the back of a fag packet, but we have done the numbers. Funnily enough, stupidly enough, I didn't do the numbers first when we actually bought the building, but I just looked at it from a commercial point of view, the one we're talking about in Dundee, and I did all my numbers based on my market research and the cost I thought it was going to do to make to refurb the building. But actually, after we'd bought it and we've done the work and I started getting asked some questions, I think, do you know what? We need to assess this. If we were going to do this as flats, what would it have cost?
Mm-hmm.
So we went through the numbers and sure, the development cost was more, but obviously the end value was higher.
Mm-hmm.
But the challenge with resi is that unless you're doing SA or something where there's a higher ROI, a lot of the time it's like 5%, 6%, something like that. And actually your money can make it can do better elsewhere.
Yeah.
So a lot of people liquidate, sell, then go again. The problem is your momentum gets taken away. You have to pay tax and all that sort of stuff. So when you actually looked at that building and said, right, if we did this as a development of flats and sold them, which would be the default position for people to do, it actually contributes the same amount every year to our main business as it would if we'd sold it all after tax.
Right.
Once.
Yep.
So, but originally, I didn't really have the proof of that. I just thought, well, it's much better doing this as commercial. It makes more sense. It's more cash flow. But when you actually did the numbers, like, holy moly, this actually makes, certainly within 2 years, the same it would doing the whole project and selling it and moving on to another one.
Yeah. And you've got that recurring every year, I guess. Yeah. So, yeah, why not?
People a lot of people just don't look at it that way. Mm. But this building we're in right now, I know listeners can't hear, but this particular one, you were mentioning about fire doors and stuff. The original doors, part of the way reasoning, apart from we weren't changing use, although we did change use downstairs, but nevertheless, in the general, we were keeping to class 4, was we didn't have to have double doors off of fire stairs, partly because they weren't there, but also because it was all under one management.
So your lobbies to your compartmentation, yep.
So that really made a big difference.
Yeah.
Big difference.
And that becomes a challenge, doesn't it, when you're making new intrusions into walls, historic fabric and things like that. That's when conservation officers and heritage specialists, they want more and more and more detail.
Yeah.
And it's the detail that takes the time, which then adds to the...
Yeah, and of course, there's the arguments which happen, or the discussions that happen between, particularly if you've got an officer coming in who's more on the historic side, that historic planning application is the conflict with modern building control and actually trying to get them in the same room to have a conversation to make agreements. But sometimes, as you say, the lines do get more blurred.
Yes.
Because there's an understanding that actually we can't quite get the fireproofing right if we do this, but if we do it this way, that's going to give us the provision that we need because actually the type of use you're looking at doing and the occupancy rate is going to be such that actually that would work.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, sometimes it can be...
Yeah, well, I imagine looking in this room, the travel distances to fire escapes and things like that, they might be slightly longer, I would guess, than what would be allowed if it was, like you said, a shiny new box office. Yeah. So, yeah, you say there are benefits in a way. We're not saying put people's lives at risks.
Of course.
But, yeah, it certainly means the space is a bit more flexible, doesn't it?
The whole thing's a bit more flexible, isn't it? And sometimes it's like, I mean, I'm a complete tangent, but with lending... Sometimes if you're going to a certain high street lender, they have an absolute square peg hole solution. And if you're around, you're never going to fit in it. And you need a secondary tier bank who actually understands, okay, the principle's still the same. I see where the quirks are here. We're willing to take that on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with those planning officers and building control. If you can find ones that are a bit more amenable, great.
So on the lending,
so
this is one thing I found. Obviously, you just mentioned there is a smaller pool of people who are willing to take that chance.
Yeah.
And obviously, because there's a smaller pool, there are, it might be a high percentage on your interest rate. It might be a lower loan to GDV or loan to cost or whatever as well. So just bear that in mind when you're doing your developments as well. You might need a little bit more cash injected up front.
Brilliant. Yeah, you were bringing me on to the final bit I want to talk about. It was just, okay, we've talked about the process, extra people needed. I'm just going to pause mm-hmm. for a second. One of the things that we've done that has definitely worked on our B-listed buildings was we have invested a lot up front in the detailed analysis, the drawings, the whole statements, all that stuff. So when it goes through planning, it really is almost a fait accompli. You mentioned on the previous podcast about bringing them out as early as possible so they get buy-in and they feel they're part of the project and they're on your side of the table rather than the other side of the table.
Yeah.
It's really important, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I know I have a business in this, but it is very, very important when you're working on these particular heritage assets to get the right advice early on. We've been working on a project recently where the developer cracked on before things like their written scheme of investigation and all of that kind of WSIs were complete, and found medieval human remains that they were smashing through.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, there is a jail sentence attached to that
if
things went
progress,
too far.
Yes.
Yeah. So just be very, very careful. And yeah, I mean, get people out on viewings as well, because, you know, I'm saying I've converted a church and you've done things like this. You might go to something that is listed that is so special that there is not hope in hell of you ever getting what you want to do. So you would rather pay a little bit of money up front to stop you spending thousands and thousands in planning and holding costs and just obviously kibosh the whole deal. Just get that advice early on.
Get that clarity up front.
Yeah. And also it comes to the conditions attached as well. And this is on any application, not just listed building, but the more detail you put into an application up front, the less restrictive your conditions will be at the other side. So like you were saying there about putting all of your detail up front, I imagine that made the process easier out of the other side.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, what you'll end up with is, right, well, we need you to investigate further here. We need you to do more research on that. We need you to record this. And this is when people get to site, or they're all guns blazing. We've got the contractor starting tomorrow. Right, can we discharge our planning conditions, our listed building conditions? There's about 9 months of us watching you here because you haven't provided enough information up front. And that's when the cost starts spiraling.
Yeah. So, yeah, you have to spend a bit more up front.
You do.
To make sure that. But in our two cases, two B-listed ones we've done, both times we spent and invest a lot of time and money in making sure when that application form went in, we had some conditions, right? But they were pretty minimal.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing is my approach with these buildings is make them sustainable, but try not change the fabric to do that. And so I've showed you earlier, we've got an example in this building where we've had an extra set of stairs. Now, we didn't take them out. It would have made things probably a wee bit more easy and we could have used the space better. But actually, we've just created a T-point on one, storage on another level, etc. Because at some point, we're just custodians. Somebody else is going to come along, right? This building's still going to be here, I hope. So they might come along and say, who on earth took these stairs out? We need them now to get a flat in or whatever it is. And actually, it's not our job to take all that stuff out. It's just to preserve it, make the best use of the space we can, and just remember we're custodians. But anyway,
I think it can make quirky, like you said, quirky interiors as well. Yeah. And this is the bit of architecture I like. You've got the outside walls. How do you make the inside work? It's more of a puzzle.
Yes.
When you're just building shiny glass boxes, you can make things larger and, you know, tweak that there and all of this. I think it's more of a game of Tetris trying to convert the inside of one of these.
Trying to work out how do I get a lettable space out of this
when
it's a corridor?
Yeah. And you were showing me around, how do you get to that room without walking through that room and all this kind of stuff? It becomes more of a challenge. It does, more interesting in my head.
Okay, right. So what are some of the things that we should touch on the actual development process, but we'll come back to that. But just what are some of the things that people listening to this that are considering or been looking at listed buildings, what are some of the other things they need to think about? We mentioned about time, mentioned about being planning and working yourself up front and getting things done. What are some of the other things that we need to do just to ensure the project moves smoothly? And I guess that does come onto the development side. So we've got on site, we always discover things we didn't know were there.
Yes.
So, you know, just talk through some of the things that people should do or maybe shouldn't do when that happens?
Well, don't just crack on, I guess. Yeah, because yeah, like I mentioned with the medieval skeletons, if you find something that is significant and you just remove it, the cost implications in having to put it back or the prison sentence in destroying something of national importance could be quite severe. So yeah, definitely be upfront and obviously, yeah, do talk to your heritage consultants and that kind of thing. What else? Yeah, you might need specialist trades. So looking around this building, your coving and stuff like that, you know, some buildings have really, really ornate and decorative covings.
And that's one of the stipulations, yeah.
That can be very expensive to put right. So just being aware, I guess. I mean, that's not to say it's not a goer, because what you might have to do if you, I'll use the example of converting to resi, you might be able to actually put a drop ceiling underneath that coving and just lock it away forever. And that sometimes that's good enough for heritage. You know, you're not changing anything. It's there. It's still honest. It's still as it was. You're just preserving it behind a false ceiling.
It's funny, isn't it, though? How many of us have gone to sites, right, taken out a ceiling and said, why did they ever cover up that coving? Isn't it beautiful? Yeah,
because that corner was damaged and it cost £15,000 to put right.
Well, there you go. Yeah. It's interesting, though, isn't it, how many layers can get added to these buildings.
Yeah.
And part of our job sometimes is just stripping back layer upon layer upon layer. The problem is, if you've got a main contractor doing that, it's those variations and how you deal with that. I mean, yeah.
I mean, this comes again to having a good look around the building and recording everything up front. You want to obviously limit the amount of variations, because that's when your £1 million budget goes to £2 million. Yeah. And we've all seen it on grand designs and stuff where at the end they've divorced the couple, remortgaged several properties just to get through a project. So yeah, again, it just comes down to the information up front. Just make sure you've got a thorough schedule together, recording surveys, and you've kind of explored, I guess. I mean, you'll be able to, when you get a set of plans, realize, why is that wall so thick? Or, you know, why is that there? That doesn't line up with what's over the top of it. You can kind of get a general feel for where little interesting areas might be. But yeah, definitely spend some time up front getting things correct.
Right, okay. Right, Anthony, is there anything else we need to think about to pass on about dealing with these types of buildings? I mean, the question originally just was, look, you know, is it worth doing these things? What are some of the things I need to look out for? Mm-hmm. I think we've covered most things, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, the ultimate answer is yes. There you go. Yeah. End of podcast.
I guess the one other thing is numbers. Let's just talk quite a bit about numbers. So yes, there's more costs for professionals for the project. But in terms of build, have you ever kind of thought to yourself, well, looks like there's an average of 15% extra, 20% extra?
I haven't really worked that out yet. Yeah. I guess it comes down to, now I've developed my own. Obviously, I've done this for clients in the past, and you think, oh yeah, that was a bit expensive. But now you see why. So again, I'll use this room we're sat in at the moment. I mean, what's the ceiling here? 5 meters?
Yeah, at least,
so just the logistics of working at that height.
Leading scaffolds, everything else.
Yeah. So just getting a plasterboard up, if you were adding insulated plasterboard or something like that, it does take a lot longer.
Yeah.
So again, it just comes down to time, really. I don't think there's a massive uptick in the cost of things. It's just there are higher ceilings. It's the materials. You know, everything's 2.4 meters when you're building new, because that's the size of a plasterboard. If it's double that or triple that, you know, that's a hell of a lot. It's not just pound per square foot as in the floor area. So yes, it's those costs, I think, that impact the development.
In terms of the listings, sometimes the interior is listed and there's certain elements, isn't it? It's like the paneling in the boardroom or whatever needs to be left. With services, often you need to take out the electrics and start again.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that planning officers, particularly when they're talking about internal, that they are willing to help with the location of fresh services, or actually that sometimes putting in a new radiator is just not going to work? Because sometimes the surface mounted, sometimes they want under, you know, but sometimes it's not possible. You've got a stone flagged floor, right? You've got walls that are maybe stone.
Yeah.
Possibly there's we've got some plaster on there on some old bits of horse hair and everything else. But what's your...
So a lot of the time, I think the default for the conservation officer would be for surface mounted, so conduit and trunking and that kind of thing.
Yes.
So although it isn't ugly, so I guess our aesthetic eye wants to hide these things.
Yes.
But what you find with older buildings is they like to see what was existing. So what's old and what's new? Because it can always be taken away then.
Yes.
So we've worked on like Bamburgh Castle in the past with Savills. And to me, it didn't make sense. But you had the weather-worn like watchtower and they were replacing some of the stones. But the stones were to the depth of the original plans.
Oh, really?
So they were projecting a good 200 mil, 300 mil and were like, you know, bright red, whereas the rest was worn and sand-coloured. And it looked silly, but that's the contrast they like to see, the stark contrast between what was
new. That was and that wasn't.
Yeah, rather than trying to fit it in and hide it.
We use a lot of galvanised conduit when we're doing electrics and stuff or services that come around. But heating pipes, you know, it can be difficult, can't it, to get these things in. And we've done a lot of refurbished, and not actually we're looking around, they're not in this room, but where we've taken old cast iron radiators and we've gone and sandblasted them, tested them, pressure washed, blah, 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 and put them back in. But you've still got to get the pipes to them, right?
Yeah, and the pipes often might have been...
They used to be,
six-inch ones or whatever. Yeah.
Something off an oil rig. And then you're putting in, well, what do we do? What do we do with this copper pipe? And it can be difficult.
So, I mean, going back to costs, I guess that's where, if you're going to be surface mounting things, you're not going to get away with plastic push-fit fittings, are you, running around the external of a hall or something like that? So, you need to spend a little bit more money on something that's going to look nice as well.
And that's basically where we're coming from, isn't it? Is that, these things do cost a percentage more. I don't know whether it'd be twice as much, half as much. Again, I don't know. I guess I need to analyse a few more projects. But one of the things that I think is definitely worth ensuring you do if you're wanting to go for a quirky space is, sure, that refurbished quality Victorian radiator is going to cost more than a new one, but my God, they look better.
I think there's an element of the uplift as well in that as well. So I pull back to our church project. I was, we got a very low valuation when we started the build at about 640.
Yeah.
We've had it just revalued now and it's worth, even though we're still partway through the development, it's 675. So it was given a very low value and it's worth a lot more. And that's because of the features we're adding.
Right.
The stained glass window that's retained.
So now they're with the quality.
So, those little elements can differentiate you from other similar projects that valuers might use. And all of a sudden you're getting a big premium on what might be standard for the area as well.
Fantastic. Okay. Thanks, Andy. I think we've covered everything off there. Really appreciate your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We've done two podcasts.
Drunk Olympic coffee.
More questions? Yeah. We've got a third in us. For those that are listening, and if you have any questions, don't be afraid to put them in the CPI Facebook group. And if we can, we'll try and answer them on the podcast. Appreciate your time, Anthony.
Thank you very much. Cheers.